Welcome back or welcome to the Single Track Podcast. I'm your host, Finn Melanson, and this is another episode of the Long Run Archives where I'm joined by Brett Hornig and Jeff Colt to riff on a bunch of interesting trail-related topics, including highlights from last weekend's Canyons 100K, Merrill's push to get some form of our sport into the Olympics, reports that Jim Walmsley is returning to UTMB, and the Spring Energy Gel controversy. It's a loaded episode, buckle in, but one thing to note before we get started, we did have some internet connectivity issues throughout the episode that did make the conversation at times a little bit disjointed. We do apologize, but we were able to do some editing to make it feel somewhat unnoticeable. We will nail the tech sides of this thing the next time around. With that, let's get started. This is Long Run Archives number 17, joined by friends, frequent collaborators, Brett Hornig and Jeff Cole. I am fired up for this episode. We have a loaded docket of topics. First, though, would it be a Long Run Archives episode if we didn't have an awesome contribution from Ryan Gelfie? Brett, can you talk to this?
Oh, crap. I forgot to write down the awesome Ryan Gelfie contribution. But in a nutshell, what he said was that a pack of elite runners can collectively blow up.
Explain the phenomenon. Like what opportunities arise? What drives this? Let's get into the theory.
The text for clarity reads, "I was surprised the winning men's 100K time wasn't faster. Ryan Gelfie believes an elite group of men can collectively, or an elite group can collectively blow up. Like when there's one or more people who you know are always rock solid and they start fading early, it shakes the whole field and gets in everybody's head."
Yeah. And then another follow-up text that, Gelfie sent to me was like, also, if you know, you just have the lead few people who you also know are rock solid, just happen to go out like 15, 20 seconds a mile too fast, and everyone does it for the first 20 miles. Like that does major damage early, especially in a race as vert heavy in the front half as Canyons. He then proceeded to send me the swinging bridge out and back segment. So it was from like Devil's Thumb down to Swinging Bridge, back up to Devil's Thumb. I think he sent me Petter Engdahl's split. And then he also sent me Rob Krar's split from the year 2015 when Rob Krar won Canyons. They also ran that section of the course. He went on to then run one of the, like, in my mind, like most historic Western States performances that year. The lead group this year did it 4 minutes faster than when Krar did it, which was also in the first half of his race. So like, distance wise, they hit it kind of similar too. So that was just kind of interesting. And then of course, you know, when you have a group that big, all do that, a couple people, someone's going to survive. Not everyone's going to blow up.
Well, it comes down to perceptions, right? Because if you have these images of how the top dogs are going to perform in any given race, if they fail you for whatever reason, because it's not their day, you got to be your own hero, right? Like you hear Rod Farvard talking about this in his post-race recap on Free Trail. Like he knew that he had a couple fixes that he had to make after Black Canyon, but he could be one of those dogs. And he was going to take that opportunity he didn't even wait for things to kind of play out. He was right there at the front with Adam and Petter to begin. So I think that like, you got to smash those perceptions early too.
Yeah. I think Rod did the best job of that. I mean, especially looking at his race as well. And just like where he like, I don't even know if like his decisive move came, you know, it seemed like a driver's flat, but it wasn't even so much a decisive move. It was just him staying solid the whole day.
Yeah. I mean, I would say his decisive move was in the first 5 miles, like deciding that he was going to run with Petter and Adam. Mm-hmm. And like reading through, there's a great blog post from Rod on his, you know, Black Canyons performance that folks should check out if you haven't. But reading through that, he says, like, it's not just, you know, showing up and kind of like waiting for the race to unfold. If you want to do something special, you need to take a risk early. And he did that. And like, quite frankly, that was the most unnerving thing for me last year at Western States, was like trying to take a risk early and put myself in a position where I could have my day. And if you don't take that risk, like, that's the move. The move is showing up in the first place. And I hate to say it, like there's a lot of guys who are amazing runners and, you know, and women who are competing that like by not actually showing up and trying to compete with the top runners from the get-go, they took themselves out of the race. And, you know, we did see Adam fade We saw Petter fade. We saw Petter come back, which is super impressive.
That was nuts.
Maybe performance of the day. But for the most part, like if you're not actually putting yourself in the mix, you're not going to be in contention for that podium. And Drew stepped up there. Steven was kind of there the entire day. So I think like kudos to Rod for kind of having that clarity. I think last year at some point, maybe Transvolcania, Dakota Jones basically said, I wanted to go out and go 5% harder earlier than I thought was smart and see what would happen. And like that encompasses this, like, if I think I'm fit, I need to take the risk to actually give myself this opportunity.
Can I read a blog post excerpt from Rod to you guys? Okay, this is from Black Canyon. So a couple months back, he says, having a solid run doesn't mean anything in these golden ticket races. You need to have the run of your life. I did not give myself the opportunity to have that run by starting out conservative and trying to remain as relaxed as possible in the early miles. While I think that that strategy would have served me well in a 100-miler, 62 miles is just not enough time to really reap the rewards of being that conservative, especially in a field as fast and as fit as Black Canyon. To compete and give yourself a shot at glory, you need to do something dumb and hope it sticks. There is such a thing as being dumb within your limits. I love that last part.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that. And there was another great part from that blog post where he was talking about how like he went out conservative, he felt great, but then like looking back at it afterwards, he was like, knowing with like who was up there and what the gap was, you know, 15, 20 minutes at some point, he's like, so then over the next 40 miles, you're telling me that I'm legitimately going to go 17 seconds a mile faster than the leaders and just like bridge that gap? Like, no, like you can't just all of a sudden go 17 seconds a mile faster than the people who are leading the race. Like that just doesn't work like that anymore.
Unless it's hot and those front people are making mistakes with like cooling and mm-hmm. nutrition. But yeah, no, that's spot on. And to zoom out a little bit here, I think we are all pretty excited about Rod's performance because Rod's been on the precipice of excellence for a number of years now, and he knocked this one out of the park. And that, you know, it was all time to watch. The performance of the day, I think, like undoubtedly was Katie Scheid's victory and her sixth place overall, truly projecting the Western States course in a way that I think all of a sudden put Courtney DeWalter's untouchable course record from last year into a lot more doubt and like, you know, concern of it's, you know, possible for that to go down.
Yeah, and then hearing some of the splits too that she was throwing down, it's like it's kind of like when a track sprinter runs a wind-aided time and it's like it's not a legal time because it was a little bit too much of a tailwind, but like most sprinters always say, no, you run windy, you can run legal. You're just doing that over speed training. It's like Katie was just getting in some slightly faster reps in a race scenario on the course. So that way when she does add those extra 40 miles, it won't be too unknown.
Maybe starting with you, Brett, where do you categorize Katie's latest performance in a multi-year string of great stuff? Like, was this a step function better than anything she had done last year at Western States or UTMB in the year prior to that? Like, how do you categorize what she just did this past weekend?
I think so. I mean, it really feels like Western States last year was an amazing race for Katie. And I think to date, probably one of her best races. I mean, it's either that or like UTMB the previous year, but it just really feels like Western States last year must have flipped a switch or put something into perspective regarding Katie's limits or what she thought they were, because I think this performance blows her Western States from last year out of the water. And yeah, like all of a sudden now we're thinking like, oh my God, is Courtney's course record only going to last 1 year?
Yeah. Like, I agree. No, I don't. I'm not like the conditions would have to be ideal at Western States this year to have a crack at that. And last year they were quite ideal. And like, you know, Katie Scheid, dear friend and an amazing runner. I do think Courtney's, you know, proven in years past that she's in a league of her own. But the race on Saturday, all of a sudden, you know, yeah, Katie Scheid just entered this, you know, this conversation of is she also in this league? There's a excellent tweet from Aid Station Fireball. Thank you, Liam, again, for always providing stats and whatnot. But Killian pointed out that Katie was 4.96% different from the male winner of this race. Mm. To put into context, Liam responded with Courtney's best results in terms of like, you know, percent difference from the winner were the 2022 Diagonal de Fou, where she was 6% slower than the male winner, and the Western States in 2023, where she was 5.5% slower than the winner, being Tom Evans. Katie's performance is, I think, standout for any performance, not just like a Katie Scheid or a Courtney DeWalter performance. Like, it was a historic performance in the sport of ultra running. She knocked it out of the park in a huge way.
Thanks to NAC, the official nutrition partner of Singletrack, for supporting this episode. We are just a few days away from the 2024 Cocodona 250, where I'll be racing primarily with their products, including the Ultra Energy Drink Mix, waffles, and purees. Also, in the last few days pre-race, I'm going to be reviewing my Aid Station refueling plan via the nutrition app on their website. If you're unfamiliar, it's pretty cool. You can enter the next race you have on your calendar, like Cocodona, input data like your sweat rate, finish goals, height and weight, and a bunch of other factors, and it's going to spit out a plan dialed for what's on course for race day based on all of that. It's awesome. I encourage you to check it out. And additionally, if you end up buying some product to train and race with in the process, feel free to use code SINGLETRACK15 at checkout on their website for 15% off your order. With that, let's get back to this episode with Brett Hornig and Jeff Colt.
I got a question. Is there any sort of worry about having a performance this good before Western States?
You know, she had an awesome performance in early August before winning
Valderan.
2022 Valderan. UTMB. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Katie and Coop have been working together for a couple of years now. I think they've identified that Katie does really well with a higher stimulus closer to the race than maybe more conservative runners training for a 100-mile race might do. Like, personally, I wouldn't have signed up for the 100K at Canyons, because if I don't have to run 100K that close to the race, I don't want to. Katie explicitly signed up for this 100K because the timing was in the ballpark of when she wanted to run 100K, and it was 40 miles of the shared course. She just got the best training stimulus for Western States that like she might be able to get.
I've always been curious, especially after high profile athletes log impressive results and you know who their coaches are. I've always been curious to know, like, did those coaches just get a flood of, you know, pro runner requests saying, hey, can you work with me too? Like, I know after Tom Evans did what he did at Western and UTMB, Scott Johnston's phone was ringing off the hook. People wanted to work with him. I'm assuming Coop might have a similar renaissance of interest, although he's kind of always had people knocking on his door. What do you think about this? Is this a big moment for the coach too?
I mean, I think it is, but I mean, for someone like Jason Coop, like, this isn't his breakout. This isn't his breakout, like, athlete performance as a coach. Maybe if this was like, if he was like some unknown dude, like Molly Seidel's coach when she medaled in the marathon in Tokyo, was like a massive breakout for him, because he was like the youngest coach to ever coach someone to get an Olympic medal in the marathon. I bet a lot of people were reaching out to him for coaching immediately afterward, but a lot of people already reach out to Coop. I mean, it solidifies that, you know, Coop for the, you know, he knows what he's doing.
Coop also has a lot of buffers. There's someone else answering the phones and filtering who should actually get to Coop and who shouldn't. CTS has built themselves into a, you know, well-known and respected name that I don't think he's necessarily getting inundated. But yeah, I think Katie working with him and like kind of announcing that around Valderan and the win at UTMB in 2022, like, also turned some heads, because her performance in the last, you know, 2 years has only been on an upward trajectory.
Yeah. But yeah, no, Brett, I think that question of how far out is sufficient to be ready and recovered for a race like Western States, like, it's a good question, because that was one of our big prompts in the preview episode was, you know, for the people that do come out of this race successful, great, but are they unscathed and are they ready to run it right back in 7 or 8 weeks for the big dance.
Yeah. I mean, Jeff, that's a great point about Katie too. And you're like, this isn't the first time she's had like a massive performance before another massive performance. So, you know, in her case, it's, yeah, does seem like it makes sense.
Going back to Rod for a second, Jeff, do you consider Rod to be sort of among your generation or cohort of runners, or is he like the lead of the younger generation? Because he's like mid-20s, right?
Yeah, Rod's a little younger. I think of Rod as kind of a kindred spirit in my generation. I think of Drew in that boat too. Like for me, it was like, wow, like the super hard workers won this weekend. Yay! Like, you know, we didn't see the two people on the podium being, you know, collegiate 28 minute 10Kers. And like, that's who I relate to and resonate with. And I've, you know, gotten to run the last 2 years of Western States with Rod. I feel like we've been kind of chipping away and trying to solve this puzzle alongside one another. But he is a little bit younger than I am. But yeah, I think like he's definitely, you know, I think cut from a similar cloth of like, the elite is like something that maybe we eventually earn after trying and continuing to get experience and experience and experience. And like, there's certain runners who show up and they can blow it out of the water and they're incredibly fast and fit. And there are runners that show up, and when the days may be a little bit harder, they've got more mental fortitude. They've kind of been at those low points and been, you know, trying to continue to get better and better and chip away. And to see Rod do what he did on Saturday was like a pretty, pretty triumphant moment for Drew to just be Drew home run once again. Also, I mean, so steady, so smooth.
Doesn't miss.
He doesn't miss. And yeah, I mentioned Petter Engdahl, like having such an amazing comeback. I think the announcers, I think a number of folks were kind of counting him out around halfway as he started to fade back alongside Adam Peterman. But yeah, Rod's clearly hungry for it. And, you know, he had his eyes on like this as the target. And, you know, in response to like Katie deciding that she wanted to do this race before Western States, it is a little different than being like, I really want to do Western States and this is my last chance to get into that race. So I'm going to go do this race. I'd rather, I guess, be in Katie's position, but I'm pretty certain that Rod is going to have the fitness and motivation, momentum to knock it out of the park at States.
Oh, I had one last takeaway from Rod that, you know, it seemed like one of the biggest changes between Black Canyon and Canyons was his deeper dive into the nutrition during the race. You know, it sounded like he started working with a nutritionist and they got, you know, he did like multiple sweat tests under different environments. And he said, you know, one of the big like aha moments was listening to Hayden's post-race interview where Hayden was like, yeah, I was taking out 100 grams of carbs an hour. And like, I learned that I need this much sodium per liter. And Rod clearly got that part dialed. And he said, I think he said it in Debo's Free Trail post-race interview where he was like, yeah, I doubled the amount of carbs per hour. You know, he was taking like 50 grams of carbs an hour at Black Canyon and, you know, was purposely staying low because he'd always had GI problems. But it was more so like the type of nutrition and the way that he's taking it in. And then, you know, there's definitely an amount of training to it as well. And then, you know, which we saw on the live stream multiple times, it's like, oh, Rod's got 3 bottles in his pack, like at almost all points. And he said he like doubled the amount of fluid that he was taking in per hour as well, because he always thought, you know, it's easy to get caught up in the like 1 flask per hour thing because it's just like nice math and easy. But he was like, no, I actually need like 2 per hour. So he like always had 3 on him. I think he said it was all liquid calories as well. But yeah, I mean, we're in the, you know, we're in like the eating revolution of ultra running now, and Rod's just like further proving that point.
To round out the golden ticket conversation on the women's side, MK Sullivan and Anna Cash has taken it because obviously Katie is already in Western this year. And then in addition to Rod, it moved down from Drew to Petter Engdahl, who was an early favorite to begin with coming into this race. Any commentary from you, Jeff, on either MK and Anna or Petter before moving on?
Yeah, I mean, MK, like, you did it. Let's go, MK.
Second shot.
Yeah, second shot, like returning from Black Canyons to Canyons and going for that 100K distance again and having a super solid race. The fact that, you know, the sub-hub queen wants to step up to kind of this like 100-mile distance is super cool. And I think Western States is going to be better for it. Yeah, I think the fact that the fields are now set with MK, Anna, Petter, and Rod kind of entering, it's going to be a really exciting year at Western States on the women's side, on the men's side.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, cool to see that, like, the golden tickets and who they went to. I mean, my fantasy free trail, I mean, predictions just like totally got blown up, but that's cool. It's exciting to see that. I mean, I was shocked, but also really excited that MK took the golden ticket. I just think that's super cool. And I'm sure, you know, so many people get caught up in the, like, once you move up to 100 miles, you're there for the rest of your running career. I'm also really excited to see, like, MK prove that wrong and, like, drop back down to sub ultra and also crush it. I think it'll be, you know, it's just going to be like another feather in the cap type thing.
comment I want to make is about Adam Peterman. I think in my head coming into this race, I just had this idea that Adam returning to Western States was going to be a foregone conclusion, and we would just see this battle royale of like Jim Walmsley, Adam, Hayden, John Albin, etc. on the men's side. Obviously, that did not come to fruition. Hoka posted sort of like a trip report that I just saw before this episode recording. Adam is quoted saying, "I just needed more time. I needed to get more consistent training in. I'll be back." So maybe Canyons just kind of crept up on him a little bit too early in his return back from that pelvic stress fracture. But I don't know, Brett, what are your thoughts on just Adam's performance and what could possibly be next in the next few months?
Yeah, I mean, he missed so much time. And, you know, as much as we wanted him to be like already back to like Peter God status, and, you know, that 50K, you know, gave a glimpse, but, you know, that Antelope 50K is so different than Canyons 100K that, you know, it might have given us a slight sense of false hope, because it looking back at Adam Strava for this previous training block and then looking at his other training blocks to the performances that he had, like, it would be a little bit of a disservice to past Adam to all of a sudden be able to just like smash this 100K running like quite a bit less than he was. Maybe he's not putting everything up on Strava, I don't know, but yeah, it's hard. What does Lil Wayne say? The higher you get, the higher you fall.
Further you fall. So you don't think there's anything to this free trail curse?
Well, I mean, having coached Cole Watson, who did not like trails and tarmac, is immune to the curse. Beyond that, sounds like a curse to me.
Yeah. I think like Adam and I had a great talk the week before the race, talking about some of like the hip hamstring issues I've been dealing with and, you know, how he kind of worked through those and, you know, his headspace and whatnot. And it did sound like he was feeling confident and comfortable, and it is a big return, right? It wasn't that he hadn't done, you know, any ultra. Like, this was the longest distance he'd run since 2022 Western States. So that alone is pretty big. I think, like, even from an outsider's perspective, like, not racing, Adam was the guy with the target on his back. Just like it'd be remiss to say that Katie didn't have a target on her back, like, for winning. Like, when people have as dominant performances as each of them have had, yeah, you'd expect them, like, I'm not going to bet against them per se, but so important to not win a race. And like what that will do for his mindset and his hunger and training. And I like personally really want Adam to go to Laboreto or like to not go and spectate Western States. Like, yeah, the races that are on that day internationally are amazing. And like for him to go break the course record at Laboreto would be super cool. Like, sorry, I wasn't at States. Like, I was busy, you know, continuing to progress and, you know, prove myself in the sport.
I think for me, this shows that the gaps in talent between the very best in the sport and like those slightly lower tiers are not as wide as they used to be. And even for somebody like an Adam Peterman or a Jim Walmsley, these are championship level races. And if you aren't entering into them at your very best, there's really no room for error. So that to me is a bit uplifting in the sense that like the sport is just getting better, right? Like, mm-hmm. like Adam Peterman can't come into Canyons and be 85% and just walk away with it. Like Katie, even though this was a training run for her, like she still has to race it if she wants to win. Like that to me, in a moment of sadness, because I'm an Adam fan, like I want to see him at Western. It's awesome that the sport is that good at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
For sure. I think the, like in terms of the actual, you know, race being exciting the entire time, I feel like the 50K races on the men's side and women's side were pretty hot to trot and all incredibly fast. You know, credit to the 100-miler finishers, and you know, the prize money went five deep for 100-mile, 100K, and 50K. So cool to like see that, and not to like ring a UTMB's bell, but that's great that like there's actually prize money at this race that's getting a lot of publicity and a lot of attention.
Not a lot of publicity.
Well, I mean, at 6 a.m., there were 1,000 people tuned into the live stream.
No, I mean the prize money. I didn't know about that.
The prize money, to be fair, they emailed the elites on Thursday at 2 p.m., a day and a half before the race, saying there was going to be prize money. So, yeah, the communication is not fully there yet. But again, I'm sure it's a big organization and trying to...
It's awesome that the money's there. That is the money piece. That's the core issue, right? That's awesome that that's there. And that's good. Those are good numbers.
Yeah.
And USADA was there and they drug tested all the podiums too. So that's like a good thing that also should come with, you know, an increased prize purse is a little bit more paying attention to that sort of thing. And it was there.
Yeah. We've talked about the 100K podiums, but yeah, Eli, Dan Jones, Cole Watson. Do you know if Cole got drug tested?
Yeah, he did. Yep. He had to pee in front of somebody.
Nice. That is progress in the sport where like this has been the preeminent conversation so far this year. And to see that at this race is really cool.
Jeff, you reminded me, mentioning the 50K and the 100 mile, I did a little bit of aggregating of brand performances across these three races, and TNF and Terex dominated the podium. So for TNF, you had Rod and Katie winning the 100K. In the 50K, Jen Lichter taking second, Seth Ruling taking fourth. And then for Terex, Petter getting third in the 100K. And then Eli Hemming and Dan Jones going 1-2 on the men's side of the 50K. Danny Moreno, Tabor Hemming going 1-3 on the women's side. Amazing performances. I don't think any other brand came close to that level of depth of representation across the top spots. Very interesting to me. Do you guys have any thoughts there, Brett?
I just like seeing, you know, more of these brands showing up with like a whole team to go race. And, you know, that is one of the benefits of like Canyons having, you know, all these different race distances across the weekend is like you could show up with a dozen people and they all be racing and you all like get different people on every single podium. It's cool to see like North Face and Terex being two of these top brands, because Terex is like, I don't know, I would say like it's very recent success in regards to their team and, you know, being like a regular on the podium. But it's so funny how like we've like poo-pooed on North Face's shoes for so long, and like they're finally getting good. But they have had rock solid athletes on podiums of races for so long. And it's just I don't know what it is with like North Face. It's just like the brand culture, because they've had multiple athlete managers, and like, you know, they've turned over most of their, you know, corporate employees many times through, but they've always just had like pretty rock solid runners.
And that's a huge athlete budget, right? Yeah. And like their marketing budget is primarily leaning into athletes. Like the Zach Millers, if you're a recreational runner and like you see, you know, Zach or Katie or Jen Lichter, like, and that's who like you kind of want to be, right? That's this like concept of basically just throw all the marketing budget toward the athletes, and like that's the aspirational audience is going to look up to them and want that product. North Face has always been basically an athlete driven marketing engine. On that kind of athlete like team side of things, there was also a team race at Madeira for the first time like I've seen that. Really? Where they, in the 115K, like they gave a team prize, which is cool.
Who won? I didn't even know about this.
Maybe it was across the different races, yeah. But I saw that like Richard Lockwood and Jason Slarv like posted that Norda, like, you know, won the team competition for some component of Madeira. And
oh my God.
You know, that's a cool thing to consider. This year, like, I initially was signed up to run the 50K at Canyons and was trying to find anyone who might want to share a house with me. And like the folks I reached out to from the North Face and the folks I reached out to from Terex were like, you know, Terex had a brand house and like we were all together and North Face was kind of doing their own thing. And it's like, all right, I mostly just want to hang out with friends, like, and stay with someone. Seems like you guys are all teamed up. Got it. Point made. But yeah, I think Terex does a great job of having their athletes all show up like at certain events, and they've got a deep field to show up to at Canyons. I think On had 6 or 7 athletes show up at Madeira, mm-hmm. which super cool to see this past weekend. I think, we had Ben Demon win on the men's side and Martina win on the women's side in the 115K.
Jeff had a good showing too, 6th or 7th place there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's also worth noting Courtney DeWalter did race this past weekend at Ultra Trail Mount Fuji, and she beat the 2nd place woman by over 4 hours. So she wasn't like slouching.
It was a hefty margin.
Yeah. She was doing significant work, and that's a World Trail Majors, which is, you know, something that it seems like athletes are paying attention to and actually seeking out these World Trail Majors to try to be able to compete in at least 2 of them. So
yeah,
pretty cool to see that huge prize first there. Yeah. Big race, big weekend of racing across the board.
All right. We're going on a slight side tangent here, but I think it's worth it. If I was a race director, I would create a team agnostic or like a brand agnostic competition that was more revolved around the regional component, where if you could somehow recruit people from your region to all go to a race together and find another region to compete against, that would be super cool. The Boulder Boys podcast, they often request listener topics for them to discuss. And I phoned in the request to talk about if they were to try to assemble a Boulder Boys equivalent in some other region across the US, Salt Lake City, Mill Valley, Seattle, etc., who would be the most formidable region? Anyways, they decided that it was going to be Salt Lake City, so it'd be Boulder versus Salt Lake. Some race should go host that. So if I was a race director, I would be assembling as many resources as I could to try to make like a 50K or a 60K or 100K dedicated to facilitating that competition, because I think it would crush in terms of attention and live stream fandom. And I think people would just love rising above their individual brands and running for like their region. It'd be so cool.
I was cracking up at that episode because like I couldn't tell if you asked them that question on purpose, knowing they would fall right into that trap. But like they were like, oh yeah, like we're the best region, like hands down. Like Finn Melanson, shouts to Finn. We're like, wait, we're like, well, I guess let's race Salt Lake. And then they started naming people and they were like, oh shit. Oh, and Tyler's moving to Salt Lake. Oh no, we forgot about Dakota. Oh no. And like they're like, did we just fall into Finn's trap? And they're like, did we just like talk about this on purpose? Did Finn get what he wanted out of this? And I was just dying. So like, was that planned?
Was it planned? It was a little premeditated, but I don't know if it was premeditated to make them realize that Salt Lake was truly the mecca of American ultra trail running. I think it was more just like, because it is, but it was more just to facilitate this idea of like, let's do more regional competitions and let's get race directors to try to organize around that too. In addition to trying to recruit brands, let's recruit regions if it's possible. If there's like clauses in contracts that allow that level of like micro patriotism to happen.
So the Alley Loop, which is a Nordic race that happens in Crested Butte, there's a 5K, a 10K, a kind of like 25K, and a 42K, men's and women's, and then skate and classic. Maybe there's no 5K, but it's I think three races, skate and classic are like the two different discipline, men and women. So each team needs to be a team of 12, and you have someone compete in each one, and there's an overall, like, you know, team prize. It might be teams of six. I'm like kind of forgetting it, but at a race like Canyons or Madeira, where you have these different races and different distances, put your best forward, you know, for the 50K or 25K, 50K, 100K and 100 miler, men's and women's. So in that it would be a team of eight. And like, I think that would be a really cool format. And I'm sorry, Finn, I think that might change how well Salt Lake or Boulder does. I'd probably put my cards in Flagstaff's basket, or one of these other places where they just have the absolute best runner. But that format would be really easy to do, you know, at these types of races, where it wouldn't be, oh, there's four guys from this region in the 100K. It's like, no, give us your best in the 25, 50K, 100K, 100 miler. And like, we could even do that for fun if we wanted to spend a couple more hours on this podcast, is look at the results from this past weekend based on location and actually see who, you know, who did outperform or perform the highest. But with Katie being a temporary Flagstaff resident and Jim Walmsley being back at Flagstaff, and then also every international elite runner choosing that as their training destination.
Jakob Ingebrigtsen has entered the chat.
Flagstaff's got something going on that didn't end when the Coconino Cowboys kind of dispersed.
It kind of goes back to Danny Moreno's Battle of the Brands episode that we did. Yes. Like, it's kind of her similar format. We just need to add a little bit of like regionality to it.
Yeah. And on that note, like, yeah, Mammoth also stout performer from this past weekend.
Yeah. And so the other thing I would say is, well, there's two things that are on my mind with this. And I promise we'll bring it back to it. One more thing on Canyons and we can kind of get down the episode list. I don't think in the early stages of this idea that you necessarily need the best representatives from any of these regions to make it compelling. Like, the first couple of versions of it could be like B-level type runners from the region. But if you show proof of concept and maybe you start to raise that total team prize purse, then after there's sort of proof of concept, the big dogs come in and you have an awesome, awesome, awesome event. But like, I would be stoked even just to get like the Boulder Boys minor league team in the Salt Lake minor league team together doing battle. That would be such great TV. That'd be such great live stream.
The Boulder Biscuits and the Salt Lake Sweeties.
Dude, give me a Salt Lake Sweeties hat.
So if any minor league teams are forming, let us know. The AAA or the single A or the double A of ultra running in your region, let us know, because I still think you guys, whoever you are out there, are worth it. All right. One last thing on Canyons. The live stream. I want to get both of your takes in a second. I'll lead with my take. And before I give my take, I'm going to couch it in some context. So when I was in college, I studied political science. And one of the interesting stories that we were told to kind of help us understand differences in public opinion was the 1960 presidential debate. And this was the first presidential debate that was actually televised. And the people that it was between Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy, and the people that listened on the radio after they finished the debate, they were convinced that Richard Nixon won the debate. The people that watched on television were convinced that John F. Kennedy won the debate. Mm-hmm. And I'm bringing that example into the live stream because for the most part, I didn't watch the live stream this past weekend. I listened to it. I was out doing errands. I was on my run. I have YouTube Premium, so I kind of just like put it in my pocket and listened to Keith Byrne and Hayden Hawks kind of chat the whole way through. And just from a listening standpoint, I thought it was great. Like, I thought Hayden was a natural behind the mic. I thought he added a really interesting athlete perspective. I think if you like the traditional host commentator format, I thought that Keith was a pretty good like facilitator host, letting Hayden kind of take a lot of the color commentary. But then when I put this question out on Instagram, got a lot of responses saying this live stream sucked. That, you know, like there was all sorts of coverage imbalances. Like if you actually watched the live stream itself, like the video, only really Katie Schott on the women's side was being shown, and they struggled to show like, you know, Kareth Arnold or, you know, MK Sullivan, et cetera. It was totally imbalanced. So that was my situation. I thought it was great, but I guess it was great because I listened and I thought the listening was great. I don't know. Brett, what do you think?
That's such an interesting take. Yeah, because I was watching the whole, well, I wasn't watching the times that I was tuned in, I was watching. I wasn't ever just only listening. So I, you know, came at it from that perspective of like, to me, what it really felt like after I like finished and kind of digested it, it really felt like UTMB was trying to replicate the broadcast of like a marathon major and how they package like a marathon, like the way NBC covers Boston, which like any of the hardcore runners are like, why would you ever do that? Like they don't show enough racing. They always cut to like weird time filler things. They go to commercial when you're not supposed to. And like, I felt like UTMB added in all those things because on paper, that is what is supposed to be professional. You know, they had like high quality interviews. There was like that super strange but informative documentary at the beginning with like Heather Jackson and like going through Auburn and all that stuff. I don't know if you listened to that, but I was like, what is going on right now? And it was just like because they like had like a 30-minute break and then they cut to lots of commercials, and the graphics packages were fantastic. Like they had some cool graphics and like the races with the names and the way they did the map, like all of that, like all the frosting was super cool, but they put like a cake's worth of frosting on a tiny little cupcake. And I would have so much loved to see a little bit more like race coverage. And like you said as well, like the women's race yet again seemed like an afterthought where they like had all these men chasing them. And then they were like, okay, if you see any of the women, like make sure to film them too. And it was like Katie, because she was like mixed into the men's top 10. I don't know. Jeff, what did you think?
Also, thank you to Delta G Ketones for their support of the Single Track Podcast. I've used exogenous ketones in my training and racing over the last 18 months, and these are the best in class. There are many benefits to using ketones in your training and racing. My personal favorite is that they improve cognition at exhaustion, which is one of the most important value propositions in an ultra running context. So if you're curious to try them for yourself, feel free to use code SINGLETRACK20 at checkout on their website for 20% off your next order. And with that, let's get back to this conversation with Brett Hornig and Jeff Colt.
Yeah, I'm gonna try to be pretty empathetic for our hosts. I watched from 6 a.m. until about 9 a.m. I went for a run. I watched from 11 a.m. until about 2 while I did some strength and mobility work. And the thread, for the most part, like the people watching and listening, I think was pretty supportive and productive and excited about the runners. There were definitely some call outs in like honor or defense of Corinne. There were some call outs that like, what's going on with all these ads? I mean, quite frankly, there's a decision that can be made to go down into the canyons with Elon's space radar device or whatnot and like broadcast from down there, or to not do that. And like, they didn't do that, right? Like there wasn't someone down there with, how come I can't remember the name of that silly device?
Starlink.
Yeah. The space Iditarod.
Yeah.
with Starlink like set up. So naturally they do have to fill with some commercials and stuff. And like, there's these big sections, you know, through Deadwood, there's no service. We kept hearing like, all right, like, Kim Gaylord said that she was going to provide updates, but we haven't heard anything. We haven't heard anything from Dylan Bowman either. And it's like, yeah, this happens with Western states too. If you don't have a Starlink out there, like you're not going to hear from anyone. So I understand why they did those breaks. I didn't really want to watch a 40-minute movie on UTMB and everyone preparing for it. That said, I also understand why, when there are people at the finish line and there's all of a sudden interviews to have, like Hayden's like, yeah, I want to go interview these people who just finished. This is the most exciting content I've had all day as an announcer. And like, instead of switching to the follow cam of MK, you know, leaving Deadwood, they're interviewing the top finishers in the men's race or interviewing Katie. So I think that there were other things that were working against them. One of which was they had the 50K men's results frozen on the bottom. So like throughout the entire race, we'd see like Katie Scheid is kicking everyone's ass. And then we'd see 50K, first place, second place, third place, men's. And like those were the two banners that were rotating. Whereas if they had had a rotating banner that said like Katie Scheid first, MK Sullivan second, Ianna Cassius third, like that would have been the most informative thing they could have done for everyone who's just tuning in. And we didn't really get that. So there was a discrepancy in men's coverage and women's coverage. I actually thought the announcers did a great job in terms of the announcing.
Mm-hmm. That's why I thought it was good. I was like, I couldn't notice the discrepancy there.
Yeah. In the video there was, but I also understand why there was, if that makes sense. Like Hayden finally had someone to interview at the finish and was excited about chatting with people. Really, I think for that race, I think Western States, like, I feel like we've kind of proved it with the live feed at Hard Rock last year. Like Starlink can make a huge difference in getting coverage in these harder to reach areas. And I don't know why races haven't thought of it. I hope Billy Yang and company think of it for Western States, but gosh, it would be so relatable if Brett Hornig was running with a GoPro and pre-recorded footage of him running into the aid station the day before or that morning. And like, hey, this is what the aid station looks like. This is Cal Street. And instead of switching to a 30-minute Hoka piece, like be like, for runners or for folks who are at home who haven't seen this course, we're not going to switch to our on-trail correspondent who's giving us a tour of what these runners are going through. Like there's other things they can do to engage us. Same time, Hoka's paying for this. It's ad space.
Yep. Yeah.
I think the announcers did a good job. Great. Aid station tours are awesome. Talking to aid station captains, I can't like express, people are like, it's just you when you're out there. I'm like, no, like the volunteers in the race are one of the main motivators I have for doing this race. Like the aid station captains that have been working at the same aid station at Western States for 20 years, like they're making this world go round. How about an interview with them instead of someone who's like not racing, but you know, is a famous Hoka athlete.
One of the things that I was struck by, because I did watch, I'd say about 20 minutes of the video version of the live stream, latency didn't seem to be that big of an issue. I'm assuming we can attribute that to the use of Starlink, et cetera.
Well, I mean, I question whether they did use Starlinks this year because of how many spots they could have had coverage but didn't. Or like maybe they only had one or two. Like they clearly had some really nice, super high range drones. So like wherever the drone pilot was, they were in, you know, a nice high service area, which could have very well been a house with Wi-Fi from Michigan Bluff, because good drone with like big service, like you could get a couple, like maybe a couple miles away, you know, from Michigan Bluff. And like, you know, as the crow flies, like you're getting pretty far out along the course. And you know, you get to do that in either direction. You're now like almost to Forest Hill as well, but it's just a drone. So like, I feel like I'm not going to say like it was like a cop out, but like, I think that was what fooled us a little bit. It was like, they had some great drone shots, and those are absolutely necessary, but like you also need people on the ground too. And yes, like you're absolutely right.
Which they had after Deadwood.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or sorry, not after Deadwood, after the steep hill from the river.
Driver's Flat.
Driver's Flat. Yeah. Like after Driver's Flat, that was the best coverage of the whole race. And that was like runners on the ground chasing the top runners.
Yeah. And like service gets better as you get closer to Auburn. You know, there's larger pockets. But yeah, you know, with that all being said, hell of a lot better than last year. Pretty good improvement year over year.
Yeah, I would actually give it a pretty good rating based on like we're making improvements, and like ideally notes should be taken, but I thought the announcers did a great job. The camera coverage thing is a hard one to figure out, and it takes more resources, and it takes having those extra extra satellites and whatnot.
Yeah.
Well, here's one more thing to consider, because this weekend we had Mount Fuji, we had Madeira, we had canyons. So in this current era, there aren't that many top-notch hosts and commentators on the live stream circuit. Like, we have our favorites, people like Debo, people like Corinne, Leah on the ground, Brett, you on the ground, and in the studio, Jeff. In my opinion, these races are a great opportunity to kind of grow the talent pool. And it was great to see people like Hayden get a chance to be on the mic for a while. Like, I want to know who else is out there from an athlete background, from an operator background, et cetera, background to add to it. Because I think as the live stream format becomes more doable and scalable and more races can take it on, we're only going to have more weekends where there's four or five compelling conflicting races, and we need talent on all of the mics. So I don't know. It was cool to see people like get practice here as well.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I mean, yeah, I thought the commentating was pretty great. Yeah. And kind of going back to, like, you know, we were saying too, about just like the resources that it takes to put on a broadcast with like multiple cameras on the ground. You know, it takes like an entire production company to do that, but there is like no such production company that's like, oh yes, all we do are trail race live streams in the mountains. Like, any production company that you hire, like Mountain Outpost is like turning into that, but anyone else previously, they're like, you know, they do the production company that was hired for Black Canyon to work with all of us, most of what they do was live streaming water polo events. Like, yes, they have the cameras and they have the tech, but then to just get thrown out into the middle of the desert and have to make it all work, like, that's like learning on the fly for them as well. Same deal. Like, I didn't know, like, the production company that Western States has worked with the last few years, they primarily do concerts. Like, very different. Wow. Than putting on a live stream from Deadwood or Michigan Bluff. So, yeah, it just takes years to like figure out where like the best spots on the course are, and like how all these weird ass like audio and video settings work best with like the internet speed that Elon Musk gives us on this particular day. Like, there's just so many variables. And, you know, if they level up again next year at the same rate from last year, like, it's going to be great. Which then kind of, I mean, will there still be a live stream next year with it not being a World Series like major? Well,
that's where we should pivot to next. Yeah. Is, you know, the America's Championship is moving to Kodiak. It's moving to Big Bear Lake, California, down outside of LA. I mean, maybe the first question here, it probably involves a lot of speculation, because at least I don't have any inside info. What would be the rationale for moving the major from Canyons to Kodiak, especially after they spent all this time tinkering with the course, tinkering with the finish line, the golden ticket status that's attached to it, the fact that Auburn's the endurance capital of the world, like, just the list goes on of all these things that they've tried to attach themselves to.
Yeah.
Why this jump to Kodiak all of a sudden?
Okay, two things. Auburn was definitely plugged as the endurance capital of the world, like 12 plus times on that live stream, which was awesome. It's like,
okay, I can say it again now.
Yeah. Second, I really hope that FloTrack does not move into our sport and ruin ultra running like it's ruined track and field. Mm-hmm. And like, the last thing we need is some like, we want the water polos and the horseback races and the concert experts. Keep FloTrack out of it. And now to answer your question, Finn, on Kodiak, I think it makes a ton of sense. I think the timing's better. I think it's a better regional play. LA is enormous and there's a huge running population there. I think in terms of their involvement, they're going to get a deeper field in the 100, probably not quite as deep in the 100K, but still deep, and as deep of a field in the 50K. They're competing against Run Rabbit Run and Grindstone kind of for a marquee 100 in October, right? Like, the Grindstone, that is going to serve the East Coast and it'll continue serving the East Coast. If runners don't have a great race at UTMB and they want a redemption and get back in, they can kind of hop back on the horse. The like general timing of Canyons is pretty tricky for anyone thinking about the 100-mile race. Like, if Western States isn't your target, or, you know, any of the mountain hundreds in July aren't your target, maybe the mountain hundreds in August are your target. Like, Canyon's 100 miler, I don't foresee it ever being as big as I think the Kodiak 100 miler could be. That's like, that's my gut is, you know, it's a regional play in a more promising way, but it's also a much better time. And Canyons is established. Like, I bet Canyons keeps its golden ticket status. It's still going to be one of the top 100Ks in the country. Other folks are still going to want to run it as the 50K because you can run more 50Ks in a year. But I wouldn't be surprised if they put less effort into the 100 mile at Canyons.
So let me throw this point in there, and then Brett, we'd love to get your take. If I am the UTMB World Series, I am more concerned if the America's Major is closer to the orbit of when the UTMB finals are happening than when Western States is happening. This Kodiak race is going to be happening 6 weeks after UTMB. So to expect people to turn around that soon after that race to participate in a marquee event, that seems problematic to me. I'm less concerned if it's Western States, because even though Western States is affiliated, it's not a part of that sort of like direct route to the World Series. And it's 7 or 8 weeks as opposed to, you know, six. I know that on the North American continent, it's hard to find a major that is in like a decent enough weather window that's also not in competition with the big dance. But when I first saw this, that was my big concern, is like, how do you create a major here that people can run at a high level in and not also worry that if they do want to go to UTMB, they're not going to be totally cooked or vice versa?
What was the response when World Championships was in November? Positive or negative?
I thought it was positive.
Pretty positive.
I thought it was, well,
what was the response when World Championships was in June?
It was like, what the hell? Another race in June?
Pretty negative, right? It was like, it was pretty poo-poo. I think they're probably receiving pressure, and we know this because they're creating these regional races for a reason. UTMB and Mont Blanc is not going to be for everyone. And that's a cost thing, an accessibility thing. Yeah. There's a lot of folks who want to enter it. October's championship season, like the fall is more naturally a time to actually have a championship race. Mm-hmm. And it kind of gives Western States its breathing room. It doesn't mess with the old guard and Hard Rock at all. And it wouldn't, quite frankly, how many people went to run the 100 miler at, like, you have to ask yourself, is the 100 miler distance the marquee distance in trail running? And if so, did the 100 mile race at Canyons get the attention that it should have to be a top 10 finishers go to UTMB? And I would say the answer is no.
Definitely no.
If the 100 miler is like kind of the focus, then 100 miler at Kodiak in October, like there's folks who didn't get into UTMB who might want that later season 100 kind of as their champion.
Yeah, that's a really, really, really good point. How about like the location itself, Brett? Like, have you run on those trails around Big Bear before? Is that a cool place to host this type of championship level racing?
I've never run out there, but I have a couple college teammates who are from that area and have always like preached how awesome the trail running was out there. And like, I've been aware of the Kodiak 100 ever, like way before it got bought by UTMB. And I always thought that that race had the potential to be like one of the marquee hundreds in the US, because that 100 mile course is badass. Like, it's a big loop around a lake in the mountains. Like, That's one of the things that the Canyons 100 mile absolutely is not. Is like, the 100 mile course kind of sucks. Like, it's the 100K course plus 40 extra miles of like crap. This Kodiak 100 mile course is sick. The 100K course is kind of lame. The 50K course is pretty sick. And like, to Jeff's point, like, if UTMB puts most of their weight into like the big lap around Mont Blanc, shouldn't the people that are qualifying for that race, like, shouldn't the 100 mile be then the one that gets the most competition? And like, for a race like Kodiak, I think that might actually be the case. I also agree with Jeff. I think the golden ticket stays at Canyons. I would be appalled if they moved it to like Kodiak in October, and then we're like, what? We have one golden ticket race in the late winter, early spring at Black Canyon in the US? That would be a disaster. But yeah, it's, you know, I mean, it's, And I was thinking too, like, I was like, well, it's only 6 weeks after UTMB. Like, but like, shouldn't those people, like those people are already in UTMB. And it's like, if they're going to qualify again, would they really be like already thinking about that? Like 6 weeks later, it's like, this race is like the fresh opportunity for the people that are not in UTMB that year, which as competitive as the races are, like there's still a lot of people who are not at UTMB.
They're going to be capitalizing on like the coattails of UTMB just happening. All of this stoke, people are going to be like, man, I want to do that so bad. Like I'm trying to sign up for this 100. I think if the 100's the focus, Kodiak makes more sense. And quite frankly, the 50K, people can bounce back. Like people can bounce back for that 50K championship. Like I think folks will still show up for the 100K, knowing that they have an opportunity to get an early entry into UT or CCC the following year. So I think it makes more sense to me personally. I also think like the Canyons 100 of like almost being at one point, it was almost just Western states in reverse. Like, the idea of introducing some new areas, I think is really cool. I think Big Bear, the terrain looks cool. And again, I think LA is enormous in the running interest.
Yeah. I mean the potential for Kodiak to be like bigger than something like Canyons is absolutely there, as much as we love, you know, the endurance capital of the world. LA is like damn near the actual capital of the world. So, you know, I'm really curious to see how they do it. I had another thought about it, but it's also slipped my mind.
Very few North American runners are physiologically ready to race a 100-miler in April, right? Like if you're ideally put together a schedule, most people are backloading their years. They're working up to a 100-miler in July, August, September, October. October is ideal. You could even fit in like your second 100-miler of the season then and probably be in prime shape.
The double? Yeah. Western States, Kodiak or Hard Rock Kodiak, both work.
Yeah. That was the other thing that I was saying. I was like, I'm curious to see how this race, you know, like you had said, like affects like the run rabbits of the world on the other end of the spectrum, like Javelina 100 is at the end of October. Are we going to see people now having to make a difficult decision between those two races, or is that different enough where someone's like, I'm going for a golden ticket at Javelina, not that person's not getting a spot at Kodiak? Cause I still think like, at least like in 2025, I feel like getting top 10 Kodiak 100 2025 is still going to be a UTMB cherry pick. That's my lukewarm take of the episode.
I just love the idea of athletes finding it very easy to say, I'm just going to operate on this circuit for the entire season. So in sub ultra, it's so much better, right? Like you can say, I identify in 2024 as a sky runner. I identify as a Golden Trail Series athlete. It's much more murky in the ultra space to be like, you know, I think in this 2024 season, I'm going to operate on the Golden Ticket Series, because until now it's been kind of blending with UTMB in some ways. I would love to, if we're going to try to create some sort of order in the next few years, I'd love to see like a very distinct Golden Series circuit that culminates in Western States, and then like a UTMB World Series circuit. And the races don't overlap. They're very distinct, and runners can just own that pathway for a particular season.
Yeah. I know let me know if we're jumping the gun. But like, we have trail running in the Olympics also written down as a thing on this episode. Like, where does that land in championship season?
Unnecessary now. Unnecessary. And this is a new conversion for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it would certainly be nice.
I think back to the ending of the book, Barbarian Days, in which he's like, basically it's a book about surfing and like what happened to surf culture. And the end of the book, he's like, all I want is for the same thing that happened to rollerblading to happen to surfing, basically for it to not be cool again. And I want people not spending money on it. And I want my surf breaks to not be as busy. And, I think about that and like, all right, surfing made it into the Olympics. Like there's all of these things, like the commercialization of it. that have happened to a number of sports in the last, you know, in the last decade or last couple decades that we've seen. I personally don't want trail running in the Olympics. And I think there's a lot of amazing races. And I think a lot of those races have a lot of passion behind them. And like, I'm more interested in, yeah, the Tour of Flanders or the Paris-Roubaix on the biking side or the Tour de France than I am in the Olympics for cycling. I think Olympics for track and field is so cool and just makes a ton of sense. And I don't necessarily want to see that for trail running. I think there's just cool spirit and culture in it right now.
Brett, let me ask you this, because you're a big track and field guy. How much more interested are you, Brett, in the World Championships versus the Olympics for like the 800 meter, stuff like that?
I mean, like I'm a pretty like hardcore track fan, so it's like equal to me.
Okay.
But I know that a track is definitely one of the sports that gets significantly more popular once every 4 years, because and a lot of the professional track athletes would take an Olympic gold over two World Championship golds. But I guess the question that I have is like, trail running in the Olympics, like, what does that even mean? Is that cross country? Like, that was in the Olympics in 1924. Or are we talking like trail ultra marathon?
Yeah, and that's rock climbing. You know, like they stripped that sport of its soul to put it in the Olympics. Mm-hmm. It's now like, you know, like it is so different and removed from the sport of rock climbing. And, you know, like the freaks and hang dogs, like that is not represented in the Olympics. I think trail running and like the grassroots culture of it is pretty special.
Yeah, I agree with that. I love the idea of like a trail ultra marathon in the Olympics, but I just don't see how it could get implemented correctly. Like when I start to think about like, even logistically, it's like you can make a pretty nifty 10K trail loop, whether it's like half trail, half urban, like you could make it hard, like you could make it nifty. You could paint a great storyline about it, but like, are they actually going to do that? Like say they did like a trail 100K. And I just like cringe at the idea of like NBC covering the trail 100K. Like I love the idea of it, but like not in the way that we currently consume the Olympics.
Didn't you hear that Peacock lost the coverage of the trail 100K and it went to FloTrack?
Yeah. So like for $30 a month, we
it's not the direction we want to go in.
Exactly. We want to go in the other direction. But like some of the, like, I don't like I love the professionalization of like what you said, Finn, earlier, of like a big championship that, you know, comes every 4 years. It's like every fourth year we get to take a pause on like Western States and UTMB and like focus on this other thing, which is a different location every 4 years. Like the idea of it to me seems super cool. It's like you're now in like the WADA randomized drug testing pool because you're an Olympic sport. Like there's some sort of epic trials qualifier, but I just don't see how it could ever actually work. And that's what makes me sad about it.
If you had asked me before the 2023 World Championships in Thailand, I would have been so gung-ho about the Olympics. But then that 2023 World Championships, Jeff, you were a part of it. It gradually sold me over to this other awesome option of bringing all the nations together, bringing a great cross-country type format to that whole model. And then it was further cemented at Innsbruck this past year. Just amazing. And so I think from my personal standpoint, what I was hoping to get out of the Olympics one day has been satisfied by this this resurgence of the World Championship model and just like all the marketing around it and whatnot. I think to me, the most interesting thing in this whole topic is that a brand like Merrell is using marketing in a pretty creative way. They're attaching themselves to a hot button topic like the Olympics. I think they tried earlier this year with that whole like FKT movement type thing. So kudos to their marketing team for just throwing a bunch of cool attention grabbing ideas at the wall and getting some press for it, because you succeeded in getting us to talk about the Olympics and thereby Merrell.
So wait, so if you're all for World Championships and like representing your country and all that stuff, wouldn't that make sense? Wouldn't you be for it in the Olympics? Like if you just every third world championships, it just was the Olympics.
So good point. I think my answer to that is the other thing that I don't like about too much like world championship racing or Olympic racing is that it removes people in all those years likely from investing in like the UTMB World Series or the Western States Golden Ticket Series. I like seeing those disruptions happen like once every what, 2 or 3 years currently. But if we added the Olympics to that mix, you'd be seeing like almost every single calendar year, a massive trade-off has to happen. And there's already a lot of trade-offs that happen without these nationalized competitions. So that's my only reservation for not wanting to like throw the Olympics on top of the world championships.
Yeah. There's definitely a lot of reasons. Like it would be cool if like, what if they made the world championships every 4 years, the Olympics every 4 years. And then you just get like every 2 years you have a global championship and then everything in between is like everything else. Like we're rewriting a lot of things that we probably are not able to rewrite, but like, in my universe, there's that.
One other thing too, though, that I think about a lot now is there was a time where you needed validation from one of three major media outlets to grow your sport. Like there was a time before YouTube and social media where you had the worldwide sports TV show on CBS or whatever, and that's how people found out about jumping off of 100-foot diving boards to grow your sport. I don't know that we need to like go on ABC or NBC anymore and use that to grow the sport. Like we have a lot of resources at our disposal as media people that we didn't even have 5 or 10 years ago to just independently do it. And I don't know if we need to lean on that money, that influence, that model to grow. It just, I don't know. I've had a pretty 180 flip on some of this stuff in recent years.
I do think the professionalization of the sport is good. I think drug testing is good. I still think you can have the professionalization of a sport and not participate in the Olympics. I've always thought it'd be really interesting to take all of the participants in the Olympics in these different sports and be like, guess what? The final Olympic event is a 100-mile run. Who's going to win? Go. And see like if it's the soccer player or the runner or who's the one that actually holds up for it. But like the actual thought of our sport, like, I don't think of it as a graduation into like the Olympics of like, oh, we're recognized by the IOC that makes this sport legitimate. What makes this sport legitimate once again is like the volunteers and race directors who pour their heart and soul into it. And I wouldn't necessarily want to participate in the sport where like, I can't toe the line with, you know, friends who are also running, who are doing it recreationally, or, you know, it's so cool to have fans and friends like all, you know, kind of towing the same starting line.
One last quick break to thank Rabbit, the official apparel partner of the Single Track podcast. Rabbit has a few new arrivals on their website worth checking out, including new colorways for their High Country short sleeve t-shirt, their Shredder shorts, and one of my personal favorites, their Deflector sun shirts. Go check it all out at runinrabbit.com and feel free to use code SINGLETRACK20 at checkout on their website for 20% off your next order. With that, let's get back to this conversation with Brett Hornig and Jeff Colt. Breakdancing is in the 2024 games. Breakdancing got in. I'll be curious to chart the rise, fall, or just maintenance of popularity in that sport. But there's a business newsletter out there that I get in my inbox a fair bit called Trail Mix. It's Matt Walsh. And he actually commented on this phenomenon about Merrill's activation through this whole Olympic campaign. And he linked to this study, this academic study that apparently shows that just because you get admittance into the Olympic Games, you can't draw a line of correlation showing that it helps grow the sport. I tried to click on the link. It led to a 404 broken link page that I couldn't actually confirm. But apparently there are some academic studies out there that show that you cannot draw that line. So interesting.
Yeah, I could totally see that. Like, because it's not like does the Olympics make track and field bigger, or does track and field just already know that like the Olympics gets to be like this final stage? And if it's not the Olympics, it's something else. And then track and field still has this big crux every X number of years anyways.
Okay, I've got a hot take, and it goes with Sidious Maximus, Fortius, whatever, you know,
yes,
that saying is the only ultra trail running that should be in the Olympic is Big's backyard, and that should be going on the entire Olympics.
Just opening ceremonies.
Right after the opening ceremonies, and it just continues and continues. And anytime those announcers need a break, it's like, let's check back in with the Big's backyard, which is still going on.
Honestly,
because that is actually running further. That is running further.
Jeff is right. Oh, that's brilliant. That is right. Yep. Jeff wins. Yeah,
that's how they do it. 3 mile loop. Like, they don't have to make it special or whatever. And like, track makes so much sense because who can throw the furthest? Who can run the fastest? The only like trail running example for me that makes sense is Big's backyard.
Dude, I can get on board with that.
What if Big's backyard takes place on the track itself? So like Sha'Carri Richardson's running like the 100 meters and like right next to her is Harvey Lewis just on his like 95th lap.
This is what we need. This is going to grow our sport, because bottom line is that's like what attracts people, like the Barkley and then the stats, right? The stats of, oh my God, did you hear that so-and-so ran 400 miles around his couch during COVID? Like, dude, those are the things that people like catch on to on our sport. Not like so-and-so ran 8 hours and 40 minutes at Canyons.
Yeah, you're right. That means nothing to the average viewer. To someone who knows nothing about running, the fact that a race started at opening ceremonies and like the closing ceremonies is now delayed because that race is yet to be over, that is what increases the number of eyeballs on our sport. Jeff, dude, thank you so much for cracking the code on the Olympics. Like, I am 100% on board with this. Like, dreams crushed. I'm never making that Olympic team. But I am absolutely watching that now, because it also, it works across all the time zones.
Like, yeah.
Everyone gets to watch in prime time because it's always
it's just happening. Dude. I think the uphill like mountain running event type deal, like that still could be pretty engaging and interesting. And quite frankly, if you look at the Golden Trail Series results from this last week, like the top 10 finishers in the Golden Trail Series could be competitive for their country in a cross country race, right? Like,
oh, for sure. Yeah.
That has reached this kind of Olympic caliber sport. I just feel like the kind of trail running, ultra running, it doesn't translate well, but,
Yeah.
One of the best ideas in single track history.
I 100% agree with that. That's like,
and my internet didn't cut out in the middle
Thank
of it.
God. That's great. I know. It was like the sea parted. Like the sea parted ways while Jeff was talking and just gave him
Jeff,
like,
you totally redeemed yourself in this episode.
Yep. 100%. It was incredible. And thank you so much for contributing to all of Finn's social media content for this Long Run Archives as well.
Yeah. Thank you for giving us 2 million views right there. That was awesome.
I can't believe we're going to see Harvey Lewis in the Olympics.
And then it'll be a lot easier for the UROY panel to justify Harvey Lewis for like the nth number of years in a row.
So easy. I mean, if he wins Olympic gold in the Olympic Big's Backyard Ultra, he gets number one UROY for the next 4 years.
Now he cuts out.
I cut out for that. Drew Holman, great performance. UROY, take note.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that he gave the golden ticket to Petter, it like solidifies that he will be yet again forgotten in the top 10.
All right. I think we have time for definitely one, maybe two topics. The one that I want to make sure we get to is the news coming out of Outside Magazine that Jim Walmsley is allegedly returning to UTMB this year, and that Hoka is the new title sponsor. This is something that we were all talking about quite a bit offline. I wish we'd hit record, but we'll talk about it here. What do you think, Brett? What's your take on this whole situation?
Well, I mean, I hadn't thought anything of it. I think Jeff should take it, because he was the one who provided yet another like pre-episode brain blast of like, are you guys sure Jim's even running? And this is why. So like, Jeff, I will let you present your evidence.
Please, Jeff, present your findings.
Okay, I just quit everything that was open on my computer, so hopefully it works and hopefully we can talk. I'm sorry about this lag and delay. To my knowledge, like, there's no corroboration that Jim Walmsley is running UTMB. And Brian Meltzer in this Outside Run article mentions that right after UTMB, he was quoted saying, what does a world champion or like, you know, NBA champion do when they win a championship? Like, yeah, they want to go win another. But later that September, Jim like openly was, yeah, labeling Strava Run, saying, where are we going to race next September? And actually being like outspoken in, you know, whatever social media oversight he has. Yeah. On the show saying like, I'm going to seek out another race. And he hasn't said anything different. And he's not on the UTMB start list. I think it's a case of Brian Meltzer loving UTMB and publishing the news that UTMB and Hoka partnered for the next 5 years. And like including that quote as suggestive evidence. But as of right now, do I think Jim Walmsley could win Western States and UTMB? I do think he could do that double. I think we're all capable of more than we think we are. Jim is certainly capable of a lot. I think this year's Western States is going to be the most competitive for him to win, but I don't think he's currently planning on going back to UTMB. And he hasn't told me that. I haven't chatted with anyone else, but he also hasn't said anything to indicate that he would be changing his original stance.
I also haven't talked with Jim. I have not talked with Brian. The only thing I can think of, it could be the case for all we know that Jim is signed up and for whatever reason, it's not reflected on the list. I have a friend, for example, who signed up for the Wasatch 100 here in Salt Lake City through a sponsor spot. He's definitely in, but for whatever reason, it's not reflected on the site yet. So I don't know, maybe there is some sort of like backdoor handshake agreement that happened, but it's not on the start list, so we can't see it. And
but he did remove himself from the start list.
Yeah. And happened
fast. That was reflected. And like he got an auto entry by like, you know, right. Doesn't the winner get an auto entry or no? Is that?
Well, yes, I think it does. But also he did the, what was the other race there in September at the end of the year?
The
it was
Nice,
a golden ticket race as well.
Nice 100K.
The Nice one. That one might've also qualified him.
Yeah. He's for sure qualified. And Finn, no offense to your friend who is running Wasatch and UTMB, but if Jim Walmsley is like, hey guys, I'm running UTMB, you can bet your ass that UTMB is putting him on the entrance list. They're making a splash page when you go to the UTMB website saying Jim Walmsley is running our race. They wouldn't hide that. That's terrible marketing. Like,
and quite like if Hoka made some agreement with UTMB and Jim that like, hey, Jim's gonna like show, he'll do this appearance fee, like maybe that's happening and it's still in the works. I don't know why Brian Meltzer would have the inside scoop on it. And I think the quote that he used certainly suggests Jim is excited about going back. But I think that quote was used at a time where like, you know, his thoughts were in a different place. This is all obviously speculation, but like,
no, yeah, I think those are all really good points.
Let me read because I pulled the two Walmsley quotes. The first one, which you alluded to, quote, almost immediately after UTMB last year, people were like, what's next? What do you do next? Walmsley told Run recently. I feel like that's asking a quarterback or someone on a basketball team who just won a championship title, what's next? Well, the obvious answer for them is we want to come back and do it again. That's the first quote. Second quote, this was towards the very end. I think it's an example of being really fortunate that my goals aligned with my primary sponsor's goals, essentially at the pinnacle of the sport at Western States and at UTMB, he said. That's where I want to be, and that's where Hoka wants to be. And for us to be able to share that when things come together is really cool. So both quotes are suggestive that he would go back, but like everything we've seen outside of these quotes in the last 6 months would argue it's not the case.
Yeah. Well, so Jim, just shoot single track a DM. I know you're listening right now. So just throw it in Finn's inbox. You know, just let him know whether you're in or out. Like blink twice if you're running UTMB.
Yeah. I mean, I think the fact that he kind of made that stand this past fall, like that was a like pretty amazing, like I stand with the community of trail running stand, as opposed to I like, you know, am standing with this primary race series. If he ends up going back on that, like I'm not going to hold anything against him. Like I'm not holding anything against anyone who's doing UTMB. Like if that's your target race, that's great. But I think until he says that he's going to do it in a statement, I'm going to be skeptical.
If he's there, do you think he could be, you think he's capable of successfully nailing the double? Because I was looking at stats the other day. The three athletes that I know that have like won both races in the same year, Nikki Kimble in 07, Killian in 2011, of course, Courtney last year. You think he's in that rare air of people that could do it?
I think so. I mean, Jim has Western states pretty well figured out. Like Jeff said, that like this is definitely going to be the most competitive field that Jim has ever raced at Western states. But I think also Jim only had like a 6-week dedicated UTMB training block last year anyways, because he was like going to run worlds and then he hurt his ankle.
Yep.
And then he was like, I think that probably was maybe then a little bit of an affirmation that like, oh yeah, there's enough time to run Western states and UTMB with what he learned last year with his training block, which probably in his eyes was like less than ideal until he won the race, or until he was like midway through being like, oh dude, yeah, 6 weeks of course specific UTMB work for where I am in my running career, like it's good enough. Maybe Jim knows he can start training for UTMB before Western states and still win Western states. I don't know. I think there's a lot of different approaches that Jim could potentially take that could lead to a win at Western states and a win at UTMB.
Mm. I love the like Tyler Green last year, right? Starting training for UTMB before Western states and doing this huge vert block, like prior to it, like that's so cool. And it certainly worked out for him in terms of such a successful double. A lot of gym excitement. Like, where's Courtney racing? Come on. And what is Hoka? Is that a company that Courtney DeWalter runs for?
Oh man, don't even get those rumors started.
Yeah.
You know how Keith was, what was he repeating again on the live stream there? Endurance capital of the world. He kept saying, this is a good time to remind the audience that this is the endurance capital of the world. This is a good time to remind the audience that Courtney won by 4 hours at Mount Fuji.
Yeah. And also won the three most significant 100 milers last summer.
Right.
Yeah. Like, what's she going to do?
Hard Rock. That's all that's next.
Break the overall record at Hard Rock.
I'm going to offer one point just to close the book on the Walmsley thing. Cause we talked about it with Peterman at the top of the show. In this day of age in ultra running, if you can't come to a start line at or like decimal points away from your absolute best, you likely don't stand a good chance of winning, right? Like, I don't know, like how far off of 100% could Walmsley be heading into UTMB after a Western States victory and still be in contention for the win? Could like a 94% ready Walmsley still win that race? Like, what's the most depleted he could be heading into this race and still be a factor? That's something I'm curious about.
I think the factors before, you know, 2018, 19, 20, 21, whatever years he was trying to do the double and didn't succeed, had a bit more to do with him figuring out the actual race itself. And like, quite frankly, doing something is a great way to have the confidence that you can do something. And like, Jim is a phenomenal athlete. Like, he's a phenom, point blank. Like, why is he the expected favorite for Western States? Cause he has the course record by 20 minutes. Why is he the expected favorite for UTMB if he starts the line? Cause he has the course record by like 15 minutes. That experience goes so far. And like, I think
who are you today though? You know, like it's on the day
for sure. Right? But once again, like, you know, you can be a really excellent athlete and not quite have the experience to show up. So like, I know Ben Demon is going to, show up to UTMB with every bit of his intention to try to win that thing. I'm sure Mathieu, like all of these other competitors, are going to do the same thing. Jim's put it together before, and like, there's no doubt in my mind he could put it together again. If he's mentally 100% there, he can physically be 90% there, 93% there.
Yeah. Jim's really good now at playing the game. Like the game of Western States, the game of UTMB. Like someone like when he won States in 2021, he was not 100% going into that race. Like all he was doing was
on a bike.
He was on a bike and running up and down Eldon. Yeah. Like he didn't do anything specific for States, but he's so good at playing the Western States game that he knew what he needed to do on course that day to make everyone be like, oh yeah, Jim's winning today. Like I'm not beating him. He has that superpower on the Western States course. And while I don't think it's quite the same superpower yet on the UTMB course, it's close. It's very close. And for him to just have that is such a big leg up over someone else who's simply super, super fit, but isn't as good as playing the game.
But yeah, I would be super afraid of Germain next year. Like if his focus is winning UTMB, like he has put the work in and he is like, if he's committing 100% of himself to that, that's going to be dangerous, right? Like the people that have also figured it out and are now just adding to their fitness, like there are going to definitely be people trying to dethrone him were he to choose to run that race.
This is just coming to mind. I love the variety with which Jim has been outspoken throughout his career. Like not only is he a great athlete and we have gotten to witness somebody just fundamentally change the way we think about how this sport is executed and the performances you need to win and be at the top. But like in the 2010s, you go back and watch some of those I Run Far interviews where he's pretty brash. Like he is trying to clearly impose his style and his belief about what is possible in the sport. That was effing awesome. I loved that version of Jim. And in the 2010s, he's like found his success. And now he already has the confidence with time still on the clock to be represented by brands and stuff. He's trying to steer like the overall direction of the sport, saying like, do we really want to do UTMB? Okay, maybe we do. But like, here's why we should think about it more. I love that outspokenness. I love the imposition. I love the fact that he's making people think all while his career still hangs in the balance and he still has stuff to do. He still has to put food on the table through his running and working with brands. I love that. It's easy for me to say as the armchair talking head over here, but a lot of other sports have that. A lot of other athletes in other sports are willing to do that on a regular basis. He is unique in this sport. And I just want to tip my cap to him because it's not easy and there's a lot riding on it, but he does it. So hell yeah, Jim.
Yeah. He's certainly a character of influence. I mean, it's kind of like when everyone was waiting for Taylor Swift to talk about, you know, whether or not she was going to support a political decision back in the 2020 election or whatever it was. It's like, oh, the big moment, Taylor Swift's going public. Like Jim's been an advocate for the sport and its interests.
And I say all that too with changing my own personal changing opinions on even UTMB. Like I'm on record in this show saying that I thought that the UTMB live stream was fine this time around. I thought they made improvements over previous editions. And like, I now know a lot of people in that org that are doing great things and for the sport. So it's a complex world out there. And I'm just saying, I love that Jim is in it in addition to being a pro. The reason I'm thinking of it is because I'm watching that golf show on Netflix right now. Full Swing.
Oh yeah. It's not Drive to Survive. Cause that also
not Drive to Survive. It's Full Swing. And who's too. The golfer, the Irish guy there, I can't think of his name, but he's loyal to the PGA and all his counterparts are departing for LIV Golf. And he's like, no, we got to like stay true to PGA. Anyways, the second episode, it all falls apart because PGA and LIV merge, but he takes a fundamental value stand. Anyways, I know we've been going for a bit. Do we have a brief moment to talk about the spring thing? Brett, do you want to cover that quick?
I mean, I think it's interesting and I would love to just hear like,
you're the expert.
Your inbox get flooded with this, but you know, the spring energy gel controversy, it's not even spring energy gel as a whole. It's really more primarily the awesome sauce controversy. And it all really started when there was a Reddit thread that came out about someone who had access to a lab at like a university. They wanted to see what the caloric content was of an awesome sauce because, and I've had these thoughts too, where it's like when you see 45 grams of carbohydrates, 54 gram pouch weight, and then you look at the ingredients and you're
180
calories, 180 calories. And then you look at the ingredients and like the way that, you know, like the FDA requires you to list the ingredients in the order of most to least. I'm like, how do you fit 180 calories of basmati rice, yams, apple puree, and then maple syrup into this 54 gram packet? Like, I'm just like, I've scoured the internet trying to figure out how to make basmati rice that dense. And I just have always not
for thought, a product that's also pretty light.
Yes, exactly. Like, it tastes watery. It's very easy to get down. It tastes like applesauce, which applesauce is very low calorie per gram because it's mostly water. So anyways, this person, they took an awesome sauce. They put it in like a professional food dehydrating unit. And basically what that the goal was he weighed it right out of the package. It weighed 50 grams. 54 grams, that's close enough. And then he dehydrated it. So basically he took the water out of it. There's no calories in water. So then all that would theoretically be left is the true potential maximum like energy content. After he dehydrated it, he weighed it and it weighed, I'm rounding up, it weighed 17 grams. So the 17 gram powder means like there is 17 grams worth of like potential maximum energy in this powder. So if you say it's 100% carbohydrates, we're looking at 70 calories. Now, is there room for error in this experiment? Absolutely. But is there room for that much error where he got 70 calories instead of 180? I don't think so. And I actually just checked the Reddit thread again before we started recording because that the poster said they reached out to Spring for a statement, and they actually did get a reply back from Spring that basically said, very interesting. We will go and double check our findings and we'll get back to you. But this product is backed and tested by elite athletes all over the world. So, but like that was all it said. And so I just thought, I think there's something to this, and I want to see more. I want to see this poster. They said they were going to go back and test a whole bunch of other gels because you could do the same thing. There's been counter arguments being like, well, you can't just dehydrate it and then say like, that's the calorie density. Like that's like, I forget what the name of like the calorimeter that you can use to measure the caloric content. But step one, they dehydrate it. Step two, they light it on fire and then see how much it heats up a certain amount of water. And then that gives like the energy mass of it. So like step one is dehydrating it. You know, if you have an apple and you dehydrate it, it's about the same. It's the same calories because all you do is take out the water. That is what this person did with the awesome sauce. And I just think this whole thing is super fascinating.
So I'm sure there are going to be a lot of people listening and watching to this who correctly interpret what you're saying as a strike against Spring because they could be engaging knowingly or unknowingly in fraudulent marketing of their product. I actually see this as a super uplifting story because I just discovered that there are people in the world, human beings that exist, that for fun do this level of mega in-depth citizen journalism for food and for an energy gel. That is amazing.
To like, support your enthusiasm, Finn, this guy is actually a scientist, right? Like,
yeah.
He said, you can do this at home, but I did it in our lab.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I love the citizen science. It's very exciting. I don't think it's just fraudulent advertising. I think it also would be like problematic with the FDA.
Oh yeah. You're not like, allowed to be like, there's like a 10% plus or minus.
Yeah.
You know, window, which yeah. So it's like, if this scientist is even like 15 or 20% off on their own findings, it's like, okay, so what, now an awesome sauce has 90 calories, like it, you know,
instead of 180.
Yeah. And like, it seems similar to a, like a Canterbury, which on the packaging, a Canterbury says 17 grams of carbohydrates. Like the math on the package of Canterbury kind of checks out. You know, and like the other thing too, is like people are paying like $5 a pop for these things. And like, they taste good. Well, that was the other thing that I thought was very interesting is like the mind-body connection. Like even if you're underselling yourself a little bit on calories during a race, when you believe in what you're eating and your stomach enjoys what it's digesting, it can still click. I mean, like the high carb people out there are like rolling over right now, but I just thought that like, it's an interesting mind game. Like you like eating something, that's going to be better for you than if you force something down that you don't like eating. But like, dude, there's like a lot
of money.
It's like
a good fitting shoe.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of money lost in this.
Well, to put it all in context, right, is like if you're going out and running a race and it's a race in which you need good nutrition the entire time, right? It's maybe longer than 8 hours. Like you want to know, hey, I'm getting 350 calories per hour. And like, this is me doing my due diligence of like ensuring like, all right, my watch bot beeps 30 minutes. I'm going to have an awesome sauce. And they're definitely one of the most popular products on the market. You see folks with them at races all the time. And it's like, one of the reasons is folks reach for that because when you're doing your math, that one has 180, which is a pretty convenient number if you're trying to hit 350 calories per hour. If what you're actually getting is 70 calories per hour, or, you know, 70 calories from that, like that's definitely problematic for a runner, or like in the race. I guess I'll ask as like the, maybe like lesser informed nutrition-esque expert. It's like, when did all of this carb excitement come about from like the cycling world? And like, I'm still trying to figure out, a cup of white rice has 45 grams of carbs and a full sweet potato has 45 grams of carb. Like you would need pretty much a meal to get the amount of carbs they're talking about.
Yeah.
Derived from those two things. And in general, people talking about like, oh yeah, I'm eating like 100 grams of carbs an hour. It's like, Hayden, are you eating like, you know, like sweet potato curry over rice on your, like, how are you getting that? Like, what?
We'll see.
When did all of this happen? Where's the food coming from? How do they get it in such small packaging?
When you do it in the most calorically dense lab made ingredients possible, it's much easier. Like maltodextrin, fructose, glucose powders, the molecule change. We're not going to go this far into it. I know I said the word molecule, but like it mixes into water much easier than like applesauce and basmati rice. Like, and that's the problem I've always had too. Like, I've always been super skeptical because like the densest ingredient in terms of like, you know, calories per gram or calories per ounce of awesome sauce is the maple syrup. Like, that's the densest one because it's very close to pure sugar, but it's number 5 on their ingredient list. And if you have 54 grams, which is the claimed product weight, if you have 54 grams of just pure maple syrup in a packet, you get roughly 150 calories. So then it's like, can you boil down maple syrup? Like, yes, you can. Like, can you make some sort of condensed like basmati rice flour? Yes, you can. But FDA says you have to list these altered ingredients in their altered state on the packaging. And this doesn't say that. So like, that's the other hole that like I've thought about and I'm like so confused. So like, I really want us to be able to follow up with this later.
Yeah. So maltodextrin, right? I remember like the cycling coach at the school here in town used to have a 5-gallon bucket of Malto because that's what he used for the Leadville 100. And he was like, oh yeah, you just want this. That's 94 grams of carbs per 100 grams. It's essentially just pure carbs, all derived from sugar. Okay. So that's still 100 grams. Like, you know, that would be, you could get 100 grams of carbs from basically like, you know, 2 of the supposed weights that the awesome sauce is. But yeah, this trend, like I'm late to the trend of the high carb kind of running nutrition diet, but the numbers that you're sharing, you know, from the citizen scientist are certainly like concerning.
Couple things for me. There's a new thought experiment that this whole spring debacle has brought into my life. And that is, are there any other equivalent features in other categories of things that we use to make ultra running possible, whether it's shoes, whether it's poles, whether it's apparel, that we should be more discerning about, that we should be double checking on to make sure that whatever is being marketed to us, we need to like validate that, verify that independently.
Yeah. It's carbon plated shoes in the trails.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, how are we going to gauge that? I think, but I would give like kudos to Jeff Dengate and the team at Runner's World. I'd give kudos to that YouTuber that reviews all of the watches. Like people cross check all of this stuff and do it in a pretty public way. You know, running with a watch to test its 60 hour battery life. And I forget that guy's name, but he has like
DC Rainmaker.
He's got like six watches on his each arm at like any given time to like test their efficacy. Mm-hmm. So like, when I was doing product reviews for Outdoor Gear Lab, I did running apparel and hydration packs. We had to weigh them, obviously right out of the package, weigh them without like soft flasks, weigh the shirts when they were right out of the package, weigh them when they were basically drenched, put them in a dry cycle, every 5 minutes, take them out and weigh them to understand the drying times and actually how fast these wicking products or technologies worked. Like there are, you know, publications out there doing really good work to expose or highlight some of this information. And there were definitely, you know, shirts from Under Armour or whoever, like Champion, that, you know, might have advertised like fast drying when actually like they were a, you know, a poly blend that if you got it wet, it was going to weigh a lot for a really long time. And like, yeah, you find that out. And that's like why you want these non-biased review platforms. I don't know of one doing that in like the trail food space. Yeah. If there is one, I imagine that it's in cycling.
Yeah, that's, dude, damn, Jeff with another brain blast. It's like, we need some independent, like high quality independent reviewing for like running foods. Like, Finn, it's time for Single Track to start a GoFundMe for a bomb calorimeter. That's what it was. I forgot the name of it. I've remembered now. They only cost, a new one only costs $40,000.
I think it's all like very interesting, and I have enjoyed spring products. I currently enjoy Knack products. Like there's a lot of running food I like. Scratch makes great stuff. Goo's been making stuff forever. Like I think asking how accurate are these ingredients and like these tests? It's a great question that I hope someone, you know, like Rod or his nutritionist is figuring out and sharing with the rest of us.
That's what I was driving towards at the beginning of the episode when I was asking, like, how much do these coaches benefit from these windfall efforts by people like Rod Farvard? It's Vic Johnson, nutritionist. Actually, he's based here in the Salt Lake, Provo area. I'm sure his phone is ringing off the hook right now with requests. Hey, teach me these high carb ways. Get me to 100 grams per hour. We can do this.